This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Brattleboro writer Anne Braden became known to many Vermonters when she started the advocacy group Gun Sense VT in 2013. Her stated aim was to find common ground in the debate about firearms regulations, but much of the conversation got swallowed up by shouting. Meanwhile, Braden, who used to be a teacher, was raising two small children and writing a lot. And now her debut novel has been published to rave reviews. It's a book for middle grade readers called The Benefits of Being an Octopus, and it was just named one of NPR's best books of 2018. I spoke with Braden yesterday about the book and how it came about.
It's about a 12-year-old girl who's named Zoe, and she is dealing with the realities of poverty and a family that is really struggling to make ends meet. And they're all working really hard, and she's having to work incredibly hard for a 12-year-old. She's taking care of her siblings after school every day when her mom needs to go work at the pizza pit near their trailer. And they're getting to live in this trailer because her mom's new boyfriend has it. And so it's a really great, stable place for them to live. And so Zoe just wants to keep it the way it is and not have anything get screwed up.
Would you read a little bit from the beginning?
Sure. All right. So it actually starts off with a quote. "The history of the octopus illustrates the brain's ability to evolve. As they lost their ancestors' protective shells, they were forced to become more intelligent." Chapter 1. I settle onto the couch with the chocolate pudding I saved from Friday school lunch. This silence is amazing. Well, it's not complete silence. Hector is spinning the whirring dragon on his baby seat while he eats Cheerios, but it's pretty close. I savor a spoonful of pudding. How long do I have before Bryce and Aurora burst out of our bedroom arguing about something? When I left them in there, Aurora was pretending to be Bryce's cat. And he was pretending to feed her milk, but that can't last. I mean, they're 4 and 3. That's not how it works. I take another bite with my eye on the bedroom door, but it stays closed. This never happens. I glance down at my backpack. My debate prep packet is inside, and I'm actually tempted to work on it. I'm not a kid who does homework, and I definitely don't do big projects, which usually require glitter and markers and poster board and all sorts of things, none of which I have. Plus, last year in sixth grade when I actually turned in a poster project, Kaylee Vine announced to the whole class, "Everyone, alert the authorities! Zoe Albro turned in a project. The world must be ending." And then she made that sound like a fire drill and did it every time she passed me in the hall for the whole next week. But this project doesn't need any glitter. And everyone else won't have fancy poster boards with foam letters that make my flimsy piece of newsprint that the teacher gave me look like gray toilet paper. All I need is to know something. And I do. And maybe, just maybe, if I could do this and if I can rock it, all the other kids will have their minds blown and it'll be completely satisfying to watch. Who would have guessed, they'll say, that Zoe knew so much cool stuff? I had no idea. I thought I knew who she was, but clearly I didn't at all. Maybe Kaylee Vine would even stop holding her nose and switching seats on the bus to get away from me. I take out the debate prep packet and lean over the coffee table. Which animal is best? Support your selection with as many details as possible, including what it takes to survive in a variety of situations. Miss Rochambeau, the social studies teacher, says this debate will help us understand the debates that led up to the Civil War. And Mr. Peck, the science teacher, says it'll be a good assessment of all the work we've been doing about animals. And the thing is, I already know which animal is best. The octopus. When Bryce was a tantruming toddler and Aurora was a baby, we moved 4 times over the course of that year. But the one constant was this little TV-DVD combo that we toted around with us and an old DVD from the library free shelf, The Mysterious and Fascinating World of the Octopus. That DVD would send Bryce into an instant trance, and we watched it so often that I memorized every word of it.
I love hearing that. I love how you voice her because you sound so authentically 12, and not in your, you know, your timbre, but just in the way you you express the way I think a 12-year-old might actually talk, and it's lovely to hear. You, Zoe mentions in that clip or in that excerpt that she doesn't do homework because, you know, often it needs glitter and stuff, but also because she shares a room with her younger brother and sister, Bryce and Aurora, and you kind of need lights on and you need to be able to stay up later than a 3 and 4 year old to do your homework. And if you live in a trailer with your little brother and sister and out in the main room is your mom's boyfriend's father watching conspiracy theory TV, there's not a lot of chances to do your homework.
Right. It's one of those things where, you know, I think, you know, I used to be a teacher, and so often you sort of just imagine the home life that you came from. So many teachers are middle class in terms of their upbringing, and so many kids are not. And we just have to be thinking about this much wider range of experiences that kids are having when they go home from school.
Yeah, Zoe gets a lot of sort of rolled eyes or frustration from her teachers because she's not doing the work. And, you know, those of us reading the book understand why she's not doing the work, but her teachers might not, except she does have one teacher who sort of sees through her and grabs her by the lapels and kind of makes her do things differently.
Right. So Miss Rochambeau is the kind of teacher that I think she was going about her normal way of like high expectations. Why have you done the homework? You know, but then she sees Zoe outside of school and she sees her trying to get across the street with both Bryce and Aurora. And both of them are sort of melting down. And she is, it's one of those situations where no 12-year-old should be in this position in the first place. And she's having to just deal with so much and cars are honking at them. And it's just this completely humiliating experience for Zoe. And then her teacher stops by, happens to be in the car, pulls it to the side. For Zoe, it's extra humiliation. But for Miss Rochambeau, she is suddenly recognizing that Zoe is like what she used to be like and that Zoe does not need to be doing her homework. She needs to be taking herself seriously. And so she takes her out of homework club and puts her in her own debate club that she runs. And Zoe is resistant, as all get out, but over time, things start to shift in Zoe's mind about, you know, what it means to respect someone and what it means to respect yourself.
And stand up for yourself.
Right. And
argue your point.
Right. And say what needs to be said.
What made you want to write about, I mean, this is an interesting plot, and one of the things that that was so painful about reading it was that I can remember all of these feelings of insecurity from my own adolescent self. And you write really poignantly in that voice. But also you're writing about poverty. You're writing about poverty in Vermont and social issues and social class and how class and culture collide in many ways. What made you want to dive into those issues for a middle grade reader set?
Well, I was actually talking to a woman I know who she'd been the guidance counselor at one of the elementary schools in Brattleboro, and she was talking about how, you know, these kids, they never see themselves in the books. Rural poverty is never portrayed. It's always, you know, if it's poor, it's another country, or it's urban, or, you know, they just never see themselves. And she's like, you're a writer. You should write that book. And usually when someone says that, it's not like, oh, yeah, I should. But I did not grow up in Vermont and I did not grow up as poor as Zoe did. But my internal feelings were like I looked around and everyone else had two parents. I had a single mom. Everyone else had a nicer place to live than I did. And I assumed automatically that they were better than me. Like it was just like it was a no brainer. And because of that, I didn't raise my hand. I didn't have any confidence about speaking up for myself. And then actually one of the things that switched that, there was a book that I read when I was 12 about, it was called Homecoming by Cynthia Voigt. Do you know it?
Mm-hmm.
It's a girl in Connecticut who is dealing with way harder things than I was dealing with. And I was like, okay, my gosh, if she can deal with that, I can deal with this. And so that was
in other words, suck it up.
Exactly. Mm. Exactly. And so that was a little bit of a turning point. And then honestly, Gun Sense for me was a huge turning point because I would never have thought I could start an organization, much less lead an organization or an organization that's going into such heated territory. I mean, it was, if you talked to me 6 weeks before that all happened, I would have thought that you were out of your mind. You know, like, it's like, that's not who I am. I'm not an activist. But it was one of those things where I experienced what happens when people are around you who have your back, who support you and continue to urge you on and say, you can do this. You've got this.
Well, and let me stop you because people might not be aware of what Gun Sense is. So you founded this organization, Gun Sense, after the Sandy Hook Elementary School shootings, and you realized there was no organization quite like what you wanted to volunteer for in Vermont. So you started it yourself. And Gun Sense got involved in conversations around guns and gun rights and gun regulation. You were involved in conversations that were political about what kind of regulation should we be crafting or should we have in Vermont that the legislature might deal with. Also, these conversations are, of course, cultural. And, you know, I was interested in when I started reading your book with a little bit of skepticism, thinking, are you going to try to brainwash me or 12-year-olds in this book? You know, is this somehow activism disguised as just a nice story? And so I actually read your afterword or your acknowledgments first, and you talked about thanking people for showing you gun culture in Vermont. And it sounds like you got some added awareness that maybe you hadn't even learned about through Gun Sense earlier, too, about the cultural strength and the pride that a lot of gun owners in Vermont feel. And that's brought into the narrative here, too. It's really interesting how you've woven it all in.
Thank you. Yeah, that was a huge part of Gun Sense for me was finding, you know, listening to both sides and finding that common ground. And that listening piece, I mean, I think the first 6 months were, you know, having conversations with gun owners and then having conversations with people that were not gun owners, trying to explain to them what gun owners were saying. And, you know, really trying, you know, the whole idea of keeping guns out of the wrong hands as our mission came from talking to gun owners and talking about what, you know, what we all have in common. And yeah, really respecting that. I mean, that culture is so strong and it's based on, you know, safety and, you know, it's such a beautiful bonding experience between parent and child when going hunting in the woods. And I, you know, I already knew that because I had taught students and they would tell me about their hunting you know, trips and, you know, gosh, anytime a kid is not on a video on a video game, you're like, yes, success. But yeah, I mean, it just really it helped me really sink into that entire culture and really value it.
And it's not a book about guns. I mean, that was also what surprised me a little bit knowing your background is I kept waiting. When are the guns going to come in? And they do. I mean, there are conversations about guns and there are some pivotal scenes that also involve guns. But this is not a book about guns.
Right. Right. I see it as a book about finding your voice. And especially if people have told you that your voice is not worth anything. It's, you know, I think so many of us don't feel like it makes a difference to speak up and that it will make any difference if we say something, especially if it's hard and especially if we've been told those things. But it does. You know, one voice, I have learned, one voice can make a huge difference. And we need so many kinds of voices at the table.
This book has gotten a lot of really remarkable press, and it's your first novel, or at least first one that you've published. So where do you go from here?
Well, actually, I can say out loud right now.
On the record
that I have a 2-book deal with my dream editor for my next 2 books. Nancy Polson is like the holy grail of children's book editors. She's Jacqueline Woodson's editor. She's Linda Mullally Hunt's editor. Just one after the other, just incredible books. And she actually preempted an auction of my next book.
Wow.
And, yeah. That happened the last couple of weeks. I've been floating on air until most recently when I had a stomach bug and it was like the opposite.
I mean, Anne, there's a big difference between finding your voice and discovering that your voice is amplified to the point where everybody else also wants to hear it too. I mean, you're not just advocating for yourself or a cause that's near and dear to you. I mean, this is major amplification, and that I don't know whether that comes as a surprise to you or not, but it must be pretty overwhelming and wonderful.
Yeah, it's surreal, definitely. What's interesting about this book, the manuscripts that I wrote before, they're files on my computer. You know, I was trying to get them published, and so I wanted them to have, you know, a good hook and something exciting. And for this one, I sort of put all that to the side. I just said, I just want to be honest with this. I don't know if it's going to be enough of a story, but I just want to tell the truth. And I'm blown away by how powerful that can be and how that resonates. You know, it requires you to be vulnerable enough to say things that you think other people may disagree with, but to go forward anyway. And I think that that vulnerability and that honesty is resonating. And so I don't think it's about me and my words. I think it's about, you know, our human condition and how we connect to other humans.
Anne Braden is the author of The Benefits of Being an Octopus. And congratulations, Anne, on this book as well as your new 2-book deal. That's fabulous.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me on, Jane.